everybody. We're going to start today by giving you an opportunity to ask questions about homework 5. If you guys got a chance to look at it, it's due in a week and more than a week and a half. So I'm going to answer questions next time, the next Wednesday, and so on. But if you have any questions right now, I'll take that as a no. Okay. So today we're going to talk about graphs, and also we're going to start talking about sorting. And since you guys don't have more questions, we're going to start by doing a few quicker questions. So this is something we've been talking about. For a few weeks about operations on lists. So you're given a list of numbers, you can do certain things on the list, decision problems. These are two examples of decision problems. And we also talked about doing the median and the max in a list, how to do that fast. So the question is, for the list of numbers that you're given, there's two questions. One is the median 688? And the second question is the max 976? So you have two answers. The first answer is for the first question. The second answer is for the second question. And there's four possibilities. A, no, no. B, no, yes. C, yes, no. D, yes, yes. Stop in 20 seconds. Five more seconds. Stopping. So the answer was majority yes, no. I think that's the right answer. Okay, so how many numbers are smaller than 688? 12. How many numbers are in the list? 25. So there's 12 numbers. There's no duplicates, right? So there's 12 numbers here. 12 numbers here, and 688 is in the middle. There's two steps that you guys need to do to solve this problem. Step one is 688 in the list? You need to determine if that's the case. That's the first step. If that is the case, you can go on and go ahead and count how many numbers are smaller than 688, and then you know that this is what the sorted list looks like. If the question were, is the median smaller than 688? You don't have to check that 688 is actually in the list. You just have to count how many numbers are smaller than 688 and how many numbers are bigger than 688. And the max, 976, what's the max? 984. Okay, good, bless you. All right, next question. The question is the sum divisible by 5? And the second question is the product divisible by 5? And the same options. I'll stop at 2. Five more seconds. You guys want to click? I'll stop at 220. Stopping? All right. So, okay. What's the fast way to do a product? If the product is divisible by 5. You can tell me. Yeah. Yes. So see, look for any number in the list who's divisible by 5. That makes the whole product divisible by 5. What about the sum? Somebody else tell me how you can do the sum fast? Yeah.
Just add the last number.
Add the last digit?
Right.
Always keep track of the last digit of the sum of the last digit of all the numbers. If that's a 0 or a 5, then it means that, and you don't have to add numbers that are divisible by 5. If that's divisible by 5, that means that all this, the whole sum is divisible by 5. If not, then it's not. Good. All right. Let's try some growth problems that everybody loves. Well, not everybody. Some people don't. But... so here's the problem. You are in Manhattan, and you have n blocks, you have n avenues, and you have, let's say it's a square, you have n avenues, and you have n streets. And the way you walk is kind of along the diagonal. You can't just walk along the diagonal because you can't just walk through buildings, but you're going to walk the way it shows in the picture. If there's n avenues and n streets, how far will you go? What's that? How does that grow? And the options are A, it grows like big O of log n. B, it grows like big O of n. C, it grows like big O of n log n. D, it grows like n squared. And E, it grows like 2 to the n. I'll stop at 220. Five more seconds. Stopping. Okay. So the n squared is the majority answer. Okay, so one way of doing this is to figure out exactly how many blocks you're walking. Okay, so you have to figure out how many blocks are you walking. If you're walking, you're starting here, and you're ending here, and you're walking like this. What's the exact number of blocks that you're walking? Yeah.
2n,
right? So why is that? Well, for each block on this side, for this block, you're walking two blocks. For this block, you're walking two blocks. For this block, you're walking two blocks. For each block on this side, you're actually walking two blocks. So you're walking two times n blocks. And what is that a big O of? Yeah. Another way to do this, if you're totally stuck, is to make a table and say, okay, n, for different values of n, how many blocks am I walking? So number of blocks. If n is 1, how many blocks am I walking? I just have a square. If I have a square, I just walk like this, right? What if n is 2? How many blocks am I walking? So if n is 2, the picture looks like this. And I walk like this and like this. How many blocks am I walking?
4.
What about 3?
6.
Right? You can just count them. 4, 8. Right? So if you make a plot, 1, 2, 3, 4. This is n. And you plot this. This is 2. This is 4. This is 6, and so on. And if you actually plot it, it's going to look like a line. So that's the linear growth, which is big O of n. If it was n squared, as you make this table, these numbers grow like crazy. Because n squared, if n is 1, n squared is 1. If n is 2, n squared is 4. But then if n is 3, n squared is 9. 4, 16, 5, 25, 6, 36, 10. What is the square of 10 squared? 100. So it's going to grow really fast. Any questions about this problem? Let's move on to the next one. So what if you walk this way? You go... you start in the same corner, bottom left, you go all the way up, you walk one block, then you go all the way down, you walk one block, you go all the way up, you walk one block, and so on. And maybe I'll start this. How many blocks are you going to walk? How does the number of blocks that you walk grow? And you have the same option. I'll stop at 2. Five more seconds. Stopping. Good. This is better. That the majority got the right answer this time. All right, let's see. So thinking along the same lines, right? So I walk like this, then I walk one block like this, and then I walk all the way down. How many blocks am I walking for one block on this side? For each block on this side, how many blocks am I walking? Well, for each block, what happens? I go all the way up and one over. For the second block, I walk all the way down and then one over. For the third block, I walk all the way up and one over, and so on. How many blocks am I walking for this block on this, if I were to project it on this axis? How many blocks am I walking? Before I advance one block, one avenue, how many streets am I walking? That way. N plus one. So for each avenue, let's say these are the avenues. Is that how it works? Yeah, I think so. For each avenue, I walk n plus one blocks. How many avenues do I have? Okay. So let's try to plot the number of blocks. What if n is one? How many blocks am I walking? So I walk like this, and I walk like this, and I think that then I stop. Maybe I walk all the way down. Does it end with? No, it doesn't. It ends like this. So how many blocks is that? That's two blocks. What if n is two? So if n is two, I walk two blocks, I walk one over, I walk two blocks down, and I walk one over. That is how many blocks? Six. What about for n is, if n is 3? N? I walk 3 blocks. I walk 1 over. I walk another 3 blocks down, 1 over, 3 blocks up, 1 over. How many blocks is that? So notice how I do 3 times, I do this 3 plus 1. It's 3 times 3 plus 1, right? Which is 3 times 4. How much is that? 12. If I have 4, it'll be 4 times 5, which is 20. 5 will be 30. And so on. It grows much faster than before. How much is it for 10? Somebody tell me how much it is for 10? How much is it? 10 times 11? 100. Okay?
So that's a big O of n squared. Any questions? We'll do a few, and I'll try to make the last homework. I'll try to have something like this in the homework so you guys can practice. Okay, so we ended last time by talking about the growth, how much we talked about different methods of solving problems, different algorithms, and we always try to make good algorithms, good methods. That means that we try to minimize something. We talk about how when we go to the airport, we have different things in mind. We want to minimize time, or we want to minimize gas, or we want to minimize whatever we might want to, tolls, So up to this point, we kind of looked at methods for lists, decision problems on lists. Today we're going to move on to graphs. And we need graphs because it's going to help us understand how Google works, how the internet works. Graphs are a very good way to model that. And people who research on Google and search engines and the internet, there's a lot of graphs involved in that. So we're trying to find out how Google works. Let's look a little bit at the internet. What is the internet? How does it work? And I'm sure a lot of you guys already know this stuff, but it's basically a whole bunch of computers. And every computer has a name or a domain name, and then there's the computer, the physical device, and then there's the network, the way they're all connected together. One computer can have multiple names. For example, our computer science department, computer answers to www.csrutgers.edu. It also answers to bcis.rutgers.edu. It has a whole bunch of different names. And that's okay. When you type in your browser, any of those, the same server is answering. We have google.com, we have dir.yahoo.com, which is the Yahoo server. There's PAL, which is the computer science graduate students server, and so on. So what happens when you connect to a computer, when you're trying to communicate with another computer? Let's say you have a web page and you type it into your browser. What happens then? There's something that's called a domain name server, DNS, and that DNS server kind of looks up the address of the computer. And so when it's finding it, your computer kind of has to send to the computer you want to talk to yahoo.com. Let's say you want to check your Yahoo mail. It's going to send something like, hi, I'm, name of the computer that is sending the request. And the reason, of course, it's not going to say hi in there. It's going to be a whole bunch of bits, but it's something along those lines, and that's what it means. And so the computer is sending its address so that Yahoo knows where to send back the response, right? You have to say, this is my address, and so that the computer, if you have a search or if you want to get web pages, Yahoo knows where to send them back. And after a while, sometimes it takes a while, you might have noticed, sometimes it takes a while for the server to respond, sometimes they're busy, they can't take that many connections. It's going to say something like, okay, I'm available now. What do you want? And so after that, our computer sends some kind of question like, I know that you have this webpage, mail.yahoo.com, or search, a different webpage, but let's say you want to check your mail. And it says, can I have a copy of that webpage? And what happens then, dir.yahoo.com sends some kind of HTML page, the code, and your web browser, the web browser on computer, knows how to interpret that webpage and knows to put colors and pictures and links on that webpage. But the dir.yahoo.com doesn't send that. It sends the pictures and everything, but your web browser puts them all together. So that's how that works. And when dir.yahoo.com says sure, it sends this web page, and this is your browser kind of opens it and makes the fonts different sizes and pictures and so on. So what if we do not know what we want? What if we just want information? We don't know exactly what web page we're looking for, but we're looking for specific words, or we don't know what a word in the dictionary means, or we just want information about how to, barcodes or something like that. And that's how people have come up with search engines, which are just a web server, just a computer who sits on the internet. It's waiting for requests, and it knows how to search for stuff. It knows how to find the information on the internet. So if we were to talk to google.com, the same thing happens. You kind of type in, go to google.com. It says, your computer kind of says to google.com, I am whatever your computer's name is, with the address. Google, whenever it's ready, answers, okay, I'm ready to take your request. And one step that I skipped on the slide is you type in your search, right? And Google takes that search and turns it into a URL and sends that URL to you. And then you have to ask Google, can you give me the URL that is the search query? And so what Google does is, okay, I'm going to give you that web page, and then you have the web page of if you search for Rutgers Computer Science. So Google basically comes up with a list of web pages that contain the information that you want. And now we can go on and click on those web pages, right? So the thing is, though, Google needs to keep track of a list of, okay, these web pages contain these words. If you're looking for Rutgers Computer Science, here's 1,000 pages that all contain Rutgers Computer, the words Rutgers and computer and science. So how does it know which pages contain which terms? And I would like us to come up with at least three theories about that. So what do you guys think? How does Google know what words are, which pages contain the words that you want? If you type any word, how does it know? What are some possibilities? How would that work? Okay. Right. So, but how does it know that to look for that specific web page? Like, how does it, because it answers really quickly, right? How would it know that to look in that paragraph? Yeah.
Something to do with indexing.
Can you be more specific a little bit? Okay, it keeps an index with the contents of every page. How does the information get in that database? What do you think? Anything is okay as long as it would work. Like, how would you do it if you were to come up with Google?
You just analyze every page and index the contents of each page into a database.
How do you know to get to all the pages? How do you gather all the pages? Okay. So where do you start your search? How does that, you know what I mean? Like, there's millions, oh, trillions probably of pages on the internet. How do you search them all? How do you get to them? If I make a new web page today, yeah.
Maybe it searches the words in the URL.
The words in the URL, right. That's a good, that's, okay. Yeah.
If it farms out searching to a computer local to the member. For example, if you asked, if you tried to Google something and it was on record, Google asked Rutgers to look at its stuff and return a response without wasting any of Google's computational resources.
That's pretty good. So let me repeat that to see if I got it right. Every server on the internet has some kind of a whole bunch of websites under its umbrella. And Google, when Google wants to find something, it sends a request to all these servers, and all the servers ask the networks and can get back to Google. Okay, so asks servers to look for. Okay, that's pretty good. What other possibility? So basically, every server on the internet has to be set up like that, right? You have to, if you come up with a server on the internet, you have to tell it, okay, you have to make sure that when Google asks you something, you get back to it with the information that it's looking for. That's a very good distributed idea. Any other possibilities? Anything is fine. I mean, anything that you think might work. So the question is, how does Google know what information is on what? Yeah. So you're basically tagging every, when you come up with a web page, you tag certain words, and then you kind of send that to Google. So when you make a web page, that's how things happen? Or do you have any other ideas? Okay, so what happened is, in order to answer this question, and before we answer it, we try to make an experiment, and our experiment was, come up with two new words that Google doesn't know about, put them on a web page. I did not let Google know about it. I just put them on the web page. I put one on, made a link to another web. This is the class website, which is visible from the internet. I made a link to it. I put the first word, and then the second word I put on the web page and just linked that second word. That second web page, I linked it to the our class website, but I didn't make the link back. The problem is our experiment failed for the first time since this class happened, because somebody made a bad definition for one of the words, and so I didn't want to show it to the whole class. I kind of wanted to protect you guys from it. And I can go back to showing you what happened last semester, and we're going to talk about that, because I think it's very instructive and informative. But just in case that person is in this class right now, I just want to talk a little bit about what that is. That's called cyberbullying. And just real quick, it defines it by, the National Crime Prevention Center defines cyberbullying as when the internet, cell phone, or other devices are used to send or post text or images intended to hurt or embarrass another party. So I think that the intention was to, maybe have a laugh, or, have seen something embarrassing on the screen in front of 60-something, 70 people. I'm really glad the internet hasn't worked, because I didn't get to, you guys didn't get to see it. But now it's kind of erased, almost. I don't recommend that you look at it. Anyway, this is in that category, and there are pretty important consequences to it. One is that people who are cyberbullied get all kinds of emotional problems, and a lot of people commit suicide. And you probably have heard of the Rutgers student who had committed suicide recently. Very sad story. I think the problem is that people don't understand that we have a lot of power with all this information that is available to us, but we also have a lot of responsibility. And I think some people have a problem with drawing the line. And this is not to lecture all of you about this. I just, for those of you who don't know, this is a very serious problem. I won't call it a crime, but it's very serious, and it has very, very, hurtful consequences on the person that it's done to. And so another really cool thing is that Rutgers started the Project Civility, I think in September of this year. And it's a project that would help people define, the moral values, what are moral values, what is okay to do. There's videos there, you guys can look at them. I watched a really cool video. It talks about, you know, people do stuff in class. It bothers other people. Some people are bothered by people texting. Some people are bothered by people coming late and leaving early. There's all kinds of things like, you know, what is okay, what is not okay to do. And also, you guys might want to know about this. There's a really cool essay contest there. It's due. They're due pretty soon. They're due in December. And the first prize is $1,000. Second prize is, I think, $300. I definitely encourage you, if you are the kind of person who likes this kind of thing, please, you know, write an essay, submit it there. It's going to be published in the Targum and in other publications, I think. I didn't look at details. I want to write it. Yeah. Do you know about it?
I think it's only open to seniors and juniors.
Only open to seniors and juniors. Sorry. All right. You guys have time. If you're going to be at Rutgers for a while, you're going to have time. Because it's going to be for 2 years. So maybe in 2 years, you're going to get to be a senior. But I wanted to bring this up because I wasn't planning on talking about this in this class, but I got the opportunity to talk about it. You know, maybe you're curious. One of the definitions was when your stupid teacher doesn't shut up, which I think is funny, and I would have totally posted that. That's fine with me. But there were some words there that I didn't want to expose everybody to. So that's that. The experiment failed. I'm sorry. But I'm going to show you what happened last semester. So last semester, it was the spring semester. At the beginning of mid-February, I think, we came up with the two words. It was dude facial, and the other one was sheepskin can't see covers in one word. So these were the two words that we came up with. And we did the same thing. We put the first word on this page. We made a link to that page, and the second word was on this page, and this page linked to our website. And so what happened was that at the end of February, Google still couldn't find any of them. In March, though, mid-March, maybe after a month or so, it found this word. But it still didn't find this word. And the end of March, still same situation. And up to the end of the semester. So here's what happens. If you put a word on a web page that is linked to from a web page that Google has access to, then Google can find that word. If it's this situation where there's no link to this web page from the internet, this word is not found. Okay? So that's, yeah.
How does Google have access to that?
Yes, very good. Very good question. So this is not what actually happens. This is actually not what. None of these are very accurate. But before, let's see. So this just says, it's kind of a summary of the experiment, that this word was found after a while, and this word wasn't found. What actually happens, to answer your question, is Google does something that's called web crawling. So it starts from web pages like yahoo.com, and it follows links. It follows a link, well, this link that leads to this link, leads to this link. It just follows the link and crawls the web, and eventually it finds the web pages that are, so it knows about this page, eventually one web crawler will hit it, and then it will follow this link and it will find this web page. And so it crawls the web. That's why it couldn't find this page, because there's no link to it. It just follows links. And so if you want the Google to find your word, you have to make sure that there's something linking. I think Facebook stuff, it definitely finds. You don't have to worry about that. But if you're just like having your own web page and you want Google to find it. So here's a piece of the internet. A piece of the internet, this is around our class website. So the first, number one, is our website. Number two is my personal web page, and the website links to it. Then it's Moody, one of the TAs, has a web page, so I linked, our class website links to that too. So I basically made a whole list of web pages that are linked to by our website. And, you know, this kind of looks kind of ugly. I made a picture of it. So this is kind of, every web page is kind of a square, and then you can see the links between the web pages, a link says there's a link between one page and the other page if there is a... So this means that there's a link from our course webpage to Moody's webpage, right? So that's what this means. Is this picture clear, kind of, to everybody? Okay. So this just shows web links between web pages. Okay. So now, this kind of structure is called, in discrete math, it's called a graph. And what a graph means is just the kind of structure that is made out of nodes and links. So the nodes in this case are web pages, and the links are the links between the web pages. So there is a link between, kind of a directed link between two web pages if there is a link between page one and page two. And so there's other graph terminology. A source is a node with no incoming links to it. So there's nothing coming into it. Something that not no, in the graph case, something that no web page points to. A sink is a node with no outgoing links. So this would be a source, right? Because there are no incoming links into it. This would be a sink because there's no outgoing links. A path is just a list of nodes that are all connected to each other. Two adjacent nodes in the on the path are connected by a link. It's kind of an intuitive name. A cycle is a path where the first node is the same as the last node. Well, they're the same. A connected component is a set of nodes such that you can get between any pair of nodes. And a tour is a cycle that includes all the nodes in the graph. So let's take an example. What is a sink? So in our case, the second word was six flaps, spelled like you see it in on page node 11. And that was this piece. Okay. What is a source in this graph? Or multiple sources? What are some sources? So sources, no incoming links. Yeah. 11 is a source. I think that's the only source in this graph. What about sinks? So sinks are no outgoing links. Oh, outgoing links, yeah. Which one? Yeah. Okay. 10, 4, and 7. 7 is the first. 5 is the sink. Yeah, there's a whole bunch of sinks in this graph. Okay, so no outgoing links. Okay, good. What about a path from 1 to 9? You have to be able to go from 1 to 9 following the links. What is a path?
2, 8, 9.
Right, so 1, 2, 8, 9, right? Because you have to go, right. That's good. What about a path from 1 to 11? It's impossible to get from 1 to 11. And that means that 1 is unreachable. 11 is unreachable from 1. That's what we're going to call it. That's going to be our name, the name for it, okay? So it's unreachable. What about a cycle? Or multiple cycles. 1, 2, 1, 2, 1. You have to be, the last one has to be the same as the first one. So 1, 2, 1 is the cycle. What a, another cycle?
2, 8, 9, 2.
Okay, good. Okay, let's do this clicker question. So the graph in the picture, what statement is not true of this graph? A, it has no source. B, it has no sink. C, D, C, E, F, D is a cycle. D, there is no path, no A to F path. E, A, B, B, D, C, E, F, D, C, A is a tour. Stopping in 10. Stopping. Okay. D was the right answer. Okay, so it has no source, so it has a source. Right? If it's not true. Well, A is not a source. So remember, a source is something that doesn't have any incoming links. A has an incoming link for C. B has an incoming link for A from A. C has an incoming link from D. D has an incoming two incoming links. E has one incoming link from C, and F has one incoming link from E. A sink is something that doesn't have outgoing links, and you know, if you go through the same process, you can see that they all do. So D, C, E, F, D is a cycle. D, C, E, F, D is a cycle, which it is. And A, B, D, C, E, F, D, C, A is a tour. It's a cycle that includes all the nodes in the graph. Okay? A, B, D, C. And also a tour, you cannot use one edge twice. Otherwise, it's not a tour. So, A, B, D, C, E, F, D, C, A. Hopefully, it doesn't use one edge twice. Any questions? Yeah. Right. Are you talking about E?
Yeah.
Well, it's not about the nodes, it's about the edges. So it needs to use a tour, can't use one edge twice.
But you do use one edge twice.
I do? Right, which is... I think that needs to be the case. Like D, that's a mistake. So we'll say that E and D are both true, are both good answers. Any other questions? Okay. So a lot of things in real life, when computer scientists make, when you know programmers make programs for things, when they do, well, we're going to see a few examples. There's a lot of real-world applications that use graphs. And another point is that there's graphs can be directed or undirected, which is talking about the links between the nodes. So the undirected graph, each connected pair of nodes is connected in both directions. So for example, a two-way street, if you have a city with only two-way streets, that can be modeled by, you know, the intersection are going to be nodes and the links are going to be undirected links because you can go between, you know, either way. If you have a city with one-way streets, like New York, Manhattan has one-way streets, you're going to use a directed graph because point A to point B, you can't go both ways directly. So let's see, let's look at a few examples and see what are the nodes, what are the links, and so on. You can represent tournaments as graphs. So in this case, the nodes could be the matches, and the links can be the names of the players. There's a lot of stuff like, you know, trains that can be represented as graphs. What would the nodes be in the case of, you know, New Jersey Transit train? What could be the nodes in this case?
The stops.
The stops, right? The stations and the links. The links between the stops, right? If there's a link between, you know, New Brunswick and Manhattan or New York Penn Station, you can get to New York Penn Station somehow. Okay, there's Metro. You can represent the, you know, electric circuits by a graph where the nodes are going to be the component and the links are going to be the wires between them. If there are if there's a connected component and there's current on it, that means that all the components in that connected component are going to be having current. They're connected. What about a maze? If you have a maze, what are the nodes and what are the links? What do you think? Okay, yeah, probably you might need points between the links, maybe near intersections or something, so you know that if you, yeah, and the point is going to be to get from the beginning to the end. If there's a path between the beginning and the end, then you've solved the maze. All kinds of molecules you can be represented as graphs. In this case, what would be the nodes and the links? Okay, or if you just see a molecule, it can be the atoms and the connections between them. Social networks can be seen as graphs. What would be, for example, for Facebook, what would be the nodes? What do you think? Yeah.
People
could be the nodes. What about the links? Friendships between them. So if you have something like, so what is one thing that Facebook does among all the wonderful things that it does? If I'm this person here and I have friends and my friends have friends, but I'm not connected. Let's say I'm connected to this person, but I'm not connected to this person. They're gonna say, oh, this person's friends with this person and this person's friends with this person. So you know these persons should. Other. Maybe this person doesn't know that this person is on Facebook, but they really should be friends. So they make suggestions. You probably, I don't know. If you use Facebook, it does stuff like that. YouTube, and so on. Those are other examples of. Another example that we're going to be working with a little bit are maps. And this is what Google Maps, for example, does. When it's trying to figure out how to get from point A to point B. It's going to be more complicated than what we're going to do here, but this is the basic idea is that they use graphs. And so let's say that you have this map and you have all these states, and you want to know if you are to travel between, oh, you can say, the notes can be the states, and the links can be, I can get directly from this state to this state. So on the map, I can get directly from New Jersey to Pennsylvania, but I cannot get directly from New Jersey to Massachusetts. I need to go through other states. So these links could be just directly, you know, each state is connected directly with which states. So we can draw a graph like that. And our graph is going to be just a list of nodes. And for each node, we're going to have a list of connections. So, for example, New Jersey is connected directly with Pennsylvania and New York. We're going to have from New Jersey two states, a list of two states, two nodes that are going to be its direct connections. And we also have, okay, can I actually get from point A to point B? Can I get from here to France? Well, no, I can't drive from here to France because I can't drive under the ocean. I actually did a search a few years ago, and I was looking for directions to go to Europe. And they actually said directions to go to the coast, and then at the coast they said swim like 2,000 miles, and then, you know, you get to Europe, and then, you know, you're dead, you know, way, like 2 years ago. So that was kind of funny, but that's not, you can't really reach it that way, right? You have to go to the airport, you have to take the plane. If you're driving, if the only thing you're considering is driving, you might not be able to reach any two points on the planet, right? That's why everybody stayed in their own continent 1,000 years ago. So we can do something like this. We can have this graph, and the nodes can be our states. And we have links between them. This is actually, it's directed, so it's probably not going to be state. But let's just talk about a little bit about this concept of reachable. So a node is reachable. A node J is reachable from a node I if there is a path between the two. It's a pretty straightforward definition. So what are the nodes that are reachable from A? So what nodes can I get by following one link or a whole bunch of links? What's the list of nodes that are reachable from A? In this example. You can just give me one. I'm happy with one. Yeah. Okay. Just one would have been good. But thanks. That's good. All right. So all of them are reachable, right? I can go to B directly. But if I'm in B, I can go to C and D. So C and D are also reachable from A. If I'm in C, I can also reach F. If I'm in F, I can also reach E. And so another interesting thing is if I look at reachable from C, what's going to happen? What are the nodes that are reachable from C? Since there's a tour, all of them are reachable from C too. So the point is that if I'm in C and F is reachable from C, and there's a link, C is reachable from A, that means that F is going to be reachable from A, right? If I'm here and I can get to here, then if I can get from here to here, I'm also going to be able to go from there to there, right? So in the case of the graph with the states, what if we want to get from New Jersey to New Hampshire? We want to see what are the states that we need to travel to. And one way to do this is this is an algorithm. This is a method of doing this, right? We had algorithms for sorting socks. We have algorithms for doing the max of a list and the sum of elements of the list. This is the method that I propose to you guys. And it goes like this. I'm starting in New Jersey. I want to end in New Hampshire. I have a to-do list, and I add New Jersey to the to-do list. And then while I still have stuff on the to-do list, what I do is I add all the neighbors of the top of my to-do list into the to-do list. I drive through the first thing on my to-do list, And then I cross off the first thing on my to-do list. I've traveled through the state, I'm going to cross it off. So let's see how this is going to work out, if this is actually going to work. So I'm adding New Jersey to the list, and while I still have stuff, do I have stuff on the to-do list? Yes, I do. I have New Jersey to do. So I'm adding all the neighbors of my first state on the to-do list, and that is Pennsylvania and New York. I'm driving through New Jersey, and I can cross it off because I'm finished driving through it. And I still have stuff to do on the to-do list, right? I have Pennsylvania and New York. I add the neighbors of my first state in the to-do list. I add them, and that's New York and New Jersey. And I drive through that state, I drive through Pennsylvania, and I cross it off. Okay, now my first state in the to-do list is New York. I'm adding all the neighbors, which are New Jersey, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Vermont. I drive through the first state, I drive through New York, and I cross it off. And then, I still have stuff on the to-do list. I add all the neighbors of New York, and I drive through the first state on the to-do list. And the first state on my to-do list now is New Jersey. So I'm basically going back to New Jersey, and that's not cool, right? I want to get to New Hampshire in an efficient way, but I went back to New Jersey. So this algorithm doesn't work, okay? And we've seen that because it keeps going back to states that I've already visited, and this is actually eventually going to work, but it's very inefficient. I don't want to drive like that, right? Like no matter how much time I have or how much money I have, I'm going to get bored driving at some point. So we need to, how can we make this better? How can we get rid, this is a bug, right? How can we get rid of this bug? What's an idea that we could do to improve this method? What's the problem? Yeah. So take off Pennsylvania from the list and go straight to New York. How do we know which states to take off from the list before we actually go through them? Any other thoughts? Yeah.
Just use the ones that are closest to whichever location.
Use the ones that are closest to. So put on the list only the ones that are closest. Well, when we added New Jersey, we're not sure if it wasn't closest, right? So the problem is that I'm going back. Yeah, go ahead.
Add to your to-do list to not revisit states.
Yes. So don't revisit states. Okay. Maybe not even add them to your to-do list. If I've already been here, don't go there. So that's a good point. Once we've reached one node, we can like check it off. We can mark it as don't go there anymore. I don't want to go back there. I want to make progress. Yeah.
Also, don't go to the ones that have no way out. Otherwise, you can get stuck in Maine.
Good point. Right. You can get stuck in Maine, and you wouldn't want that. I actually want to go to Maine, but anyway. So that's a good point. You don't wanna go somewhere where you're not gonna have a way out if that's not your destination. Okay, so if we keep track of the states that we've already gone through, when we cross off New Jersey and we add Pennsylvania, when we add the neighbors of Pennsylvania, we're only going to add the ones that we haven't been to, and so this helps us to make progress. And this actually leads us to something that's called the breadth first search. So the breadth first search takes a node. The point is, I want to visit all the nodes. Let's say that you have a network of computers and you want to do an update on all of them. You want to take them systematically and do an update. So what you're going to do is you want to make sure you touch all the nodes, but you want a way to kind of spread the information through the graph. And so what you're going to do is, you're going to start with the first node, and your to-do list is going to be node A. Now, you're going to add the neighbors. B is the only neighbor of A, but you're also going to mark, hey, I've already been in A, I make A blue. If I ever consider starting back here, I don't want to do that. So you add A's neighbor B to the to-do list, and now your to-do list is B. When your to-do list is B, you add its neighbors, also cross it off the list, make it, mark it as visited, make it blue, And then now on your to-do list is C and D. And so you're going to start with C. You're going to add its neighbor, which is F. You're going to cross it off. So now you have D and F in your to-do list. You go to D. Its neighbor is E. So you're going to have E and F, or F and E, because that's the order that you went through. And go to F. Its neighbor is E. And now you only have E, and you visited E, and you're done. And this can be if you any kind of, let's say you're in a country, in a foreign country, and you want to visit all the interesting places in the country. You could do this kind of strategy to go and visit all of them. Another kind of search is called depth-first search. And it's called depth-first because when you have a node, no matter how many neighbors it has, so remember the depth-first says, I'm in a node, I'm putting all the neighbors on the to-do list, and I take each, I have all the neighbors in the to-do list, I take the first neighbor, I pull all their neighbors in the to-do list, but before I deal with their neighbors, I'm going to deal with the second neighbor of the previous node. This one says, I have a neighbor, I go to that neighbor, that neighbor has a neighbor, I go to that neighbor, that neighbor has a neighbor, I go to that neighbor. It goes in depth and kind of visits the graph that way. So when it also keeps track of when it's done with a neighbor. So let's say you're in a node and you don't have any place to go. Everybody, all of its neighbors are already visited. You're going to mark that as red. And that's going to be, you're going to say it's a done node or something. So you go to A. A has only one neighbor. You mark them both as visited. Then you have C and D, but you're only going to look at C because you only look at one neighbor. C has also just one neighbor, F, which also has just one neighbor, E. And now E, from E you can go to C or F, but they're both visited. So you're definitely done with E. So then you mark it as red. And the way you go back is you go back to the previous. So you're done with E, you go back to where did you come from to get to E? Well, you came from F. So you go back to F and say, does F have more neighbors? If it doesn't have more neighbors, which it doesn't, you mark it as done. If it does have neighbors, you go back and you visit the next neighbor until you're done with all the neighbors. Now you go back to C, and C actually has a neighbor that hasn't been visited, so it's not going to be made red yet. But you visit its neighbor, and now from D you can't go anywhere without going to a node that has not been visited. You make that red. Now C doesn't have any neighbors that haven't been visited. You make that red. B, and then A, and then you're done. So you're done with the graph when you've made red all the nodes. You don't just have to visit them. You actually have to finish them. So basically, this is a kind of a summary of how Google works. You probably know this already. Google was started by two PhD students, and this was kind of their project. And they actually made a research paper when they first came up with Google. Anybody can read it. Computer science people. You have to be a computer scientist to understand it. But it's very readable. When they made a product, they stopped talking about it. So I have lab mates who go and do internships at Google. They cannot talk about it. But the initial paper, the initial ideas are still known. And the way it does, it's crawling the web. So it's starting from all kinds of different pages, and it's following links. And when it gets to a page that it hasn't seen before, it takes that page, takes all the words on that page, and keeps a list of, this word shows up. So it adds the web page to the list of web pages that contain that word. And so it's basically when it's crawling the web, it's downloading the web pages. Then what it's doing, indexing, so it's keeping a list of words. And for each word, it's keeping a list of pages that contain that word. So if you look for that word, it has a very fast way of finding the word in that list, and then it just makes a web page with all the web pages that contain that word. And then it uses lots and lots and lots of computers to do fast lookup. So, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of words in the world. There's English words and there's all the languages. There are lots of words. So you need to look for the word very fast. And you probably, you've seen it's doing it almost instantly. And it's using lots and lots and lots of computers. Some people say that's the secret of Google. They don't have very smart searches or algorithms, which I don't really believe, but they just have lots and lots of computers. And when you have lots and lots of workers working together, you can do things very fast. And so the thing is, though, Google also does sorting. In order for you to have a list of words, that you need to look in that list of words. You need to find a word very quickly. You need to have that list sorted. And we're going to start looking at sorting maybe real quick today and more in depth next time. But it's relatively simple, but it's very, very important. It makes search much easier. So let's do another of these, since some people left, and we can have more credit than them. So this is a question. You have a Scratch script. It's called Who Am I? And it sets I to 1, and it repeats length of deck. Deck is a list. And actually, your deck is 78, 10, 65, 72, 31, 40, 27, 49, 31, and 96. That's the list that is called deck. And it's repeating length of deck. Inside the repeat, it's saying, if item I of deck equals 10, say yes and stop the script. And also inside the repeat, there's a change I by 1. And outside the repeat, it says no and stops the script. And the question is, what does the script say? At option A, it says yes, because it answers, is the length of the list 10? B, it answers no, because it answers the question, is the sum 10? C, it answers no, because it asks the question, is the first element 10? D, it answers yes, because it's asking, does it contain 10? Does that contain 10? And E, it answers no, because it asks, are all elements of the list equal to 10? I'll stop at 2. Okay, stopping. All right. Majority was the right answer. It's asking. Okay, C is the first element 10. So I'm not yet finished. If you guys can wait for like a few minutes, I'll be done. So this is taking each element in the list. So I does start with 1, but it's changing it in the repeat loop. So it's making it 2, 3, 4, and so on. Each time I has a new value, it's checking item I of L. So that's why it's going through the list. But I just wanted to show you the difference between a sorted list and unsorted list. So when Google gets to a web page, it sees a list of words, right? And they're obviously unsorted. And let's say it's looking for, where's the word? Can you guys see at all? Not too much. All right. Well, if you were to look for a word in an unsorted list, it's pretty... Like, it's very hard to find, right? You have to go through each of the words and check, is this the word that I'm looking for? Is this the word I'm looking for? It's a very hard problem. If the list was size n, what would this be like? What would it, how many operations would you have to do? What's the big O? In a worst case. How many things do you have to look at in the elements of the list? Yeah. So yeah, big O of N, right? Because, I mean, you might be able to find the word in the beginning, but in the worst case, it's going to be the whole, yeah, you're going to have to look at the whole list, right? So that's pretty bad. But what if you remove the duplicates and if you sort them, then it's much, much easier to find. What about, where is then, that, the word that, which column and which row? You guys see it? Yeah. But it's very, very easy to find, right? And so sorting helps a lot to find words, right? So look at this. This is a list that's unsorted, and this is a list that is sorted. Any question, almost, is easier to answer on the sorted list than in the unsorted list. So, like, if I say, what's the biggest number in the list? Where are you going to look? The bottom, right? The sorted list, it's going to take, like, half a second or less to figure out that 977 is the biggest number, whereas if you were to look in the unsorted list, that's going to take looking at each single element. So what's the big O of, like, finding the max in the unsorted list? What's the worst? How many numbers do you have to look at in the worst case? Oh, yeah. All of them. Yeah, so it's big O of N, right? If the list is, what about the sorted list? How many operations do you have to do? How many numbers do you need to look at? One. Yeah, so that changes dramatically. If the list is, imagine all the words in the world, right? That's billions and trillions, right? You have to go through all of them if it was unsorted, but if it's sorted, you have to only look at one of them. All right. So we're going to continue next time with sorting algorithms. Thanks for staying.